how long was your computer access down?
About 9 days.
Did you experience withdrawal?
No, actually, I didn't. Well, no, that's not true. I did, but it wasn't an unpleasant withdrawal. Let's put it that way. It was an interesting feeling to just relax and not worry if anybody was posting anything out there that I needed to see or that sort of thing.
It's odd how that works, isn't it? It seems like it's frightful in the moment, but there is the detachment is very clean. It because it's so organic, the brain kind of settles into its almost natural wavelengths.
Yeah, it was quite a surprise to me because I was afraid. You know, when the computer went down, I first actually even before this because I was just too busy to spend much time. I don't know if you've noticed, but I haven't been posting much at the kitchen sink lately, and I haven't been really saying anything at all on Facebook at all, and I haven't been looking either at Facebook or the kitchen sink. I've just been kind of, I sent you that message how I was. My mother had enticed me into watching pretty much everything that Masterpiece Theater ever made. If it was available on Netflix, she wanted to see it, and I ended up watching Downton Abbey. And you know, while I was looking at Downton Abbey, it's a masterfully sinkish type of work. I thought about writing about it, but I just never did because I got into this different rhythm with my mom and hanging out with her while she watched her favorite stories, you know, on TV.
You know, I've been thinking about changing gears and posting and writing about specific pieces that absolutely do not sink.
Yes, that's interesting.
Is it possible to pick out the most unsinky movie of all time?
You're right. That becomes a kind of a game very similar to Robert Anton Wilson, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and parapsychology, right? What he called the opposite of parapsychology, where you're looking for a normal event and seeing if it's possible to find it. And no, but that's the funny. As amusing as he is, as Wilson is, he's dead on the money, right?
Yeah, and I think that reversion, that reversal, is a very necessary weapon or a necessary gear that one needs to shift into now and then to kind of balance everything.
Well, I don't even know if I think, and you would. I mean, people who studied or experienced sync on a really intense or even a personal level would probably think that once you turn this kind of thing on, it can be very difficult to turn off.
Yeah, right. That's for sure.
It gets to the point where, it's almost as if it's a kind of athletic training, a kind of a mental version of muscle memory, where once you get a certain message, a certain pattern, in an exact rhythmic form, and again, you know, this leads into a lot of the stuff that we've talked about before about how when one reads, when you look up from the book, you're now seeing the world superimposed with the written word over top of it, right? So I think that once you start to see a certain pattern over and over again, and this is why parapsychology or the reverse of parapsychology is useful, and you know, and your idea is a good one, is that people should be out there trying to find the thing that doesn't sink. Not necessarily even for the purpose of reporting it, but just for seeing if they can actually even find it at all. You know,
absolutely, because it begs the distinction between the value of public sync and personal sync, I think.
Yes. Well, I mean, would you agree with me that in fact all sync is inherently personal?
I absolutely agree.
Yeah, because I mean, we have to be talking about a person's experience, right?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, what is out there, you know?
Yeah, even if you this fits in to the idea of web surfing as an actual activity similar to riding a wave on the ocean, as opposed to controlling one's research. One can get into certain types of rhythmic research that is seems to be being pushed along by the data itself, right? Which seems to have a life of its own. Like, for instance, in any of these. And it comes out of media first, obviously. And the fact that we can have a radio playing in the background while something is happening in our life. And this is how people get things like, you know, our song. You know, they say, oh, yes. Honey, it's our song, right? Well, that's a sync.
Absolutely.
And so if you've reached that level where you're going, oh, honey, they're playing our song, then you're, you are, you might not be conscious of it, but you're engaged in a world of pattern recognition, basically.
Yeah, but yeah. You're clothing something with an alternative definition, a softer definition. Maybe that's the whole thing about poetry, right? The poetry was so revered because it spoke to something that was universal, but yet extremely local, because you would be defining something as specific as the way water falls off a flower petal or something like that. You know,
That's a very interesting, you know, Odin, interestingly enough, W.H. Odin, the poet, said exactly that. He said, poetry is like a valley cheese. It's local, but it's prized elsewhere, basically.
Yeah, yeah. You could and be...
Sorry, Bill. I think you're on the money, though, with that, in regards to poetry, because it's... And how it relates to sync, too, because you have this experience. If we're comparing a sync experience to a universal experience, and I think that's fundamental, too, to the whole concept of sync right now. Like it or lump it, it's tied into an idea of something that's happening on a cosmic level, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we have the two things combined automatically. We have the sense of a cosmic nature and the sense of a personal nature, and they've begun to dance. And it, to me, patterning it visually, it's very much like a maelstrom, right? And, you know, that's why the word sync implies so well, because everything is sinking together into a, or appears to be. And this is the big question. Is it just an appearance? Because you yourself said we're clothing it in something else, right?
Yes.
So we have this idea of when we experience a sink, and I'd like to know what you think about this. Do you think it's a side effect of nature? Do you believe that it is somehow separate from or nature necessarily? Like, it can anything be separate from nature in that way?
You know, I'm kind of thinking that sync is the sound of the gears between local and non-locality turning.
Okay, that's really good. Yeah, I get it.
Because there's. I refer to, you know, the reoccurrence of the word tip in Finnegan's Wake. There's just this...
Okay,
so like that little sound, that little echo of something reoccurring, it could be clothed in just a simple little three-letter word, or it could be expressed as a sink in waking life.
I like your expression of sync being the sound of the gears and the way, but I guess what I'm implying here is in the way in which we see it, in the way in which we experience sync, in because of the personal and the cosmic, let's put it this way. If we become consciously aware of those gears at work, aren't we jumping our head up to a cosmic level? Or do you think it's just a blunt sort of thing? Oh, I hear this tippity tip tip.
Well, isn't it that's the giggle, is that the cosmic level is right here with us right now. So
right.
I understand the language as far as the conversation to jump up to it is to open your eyes to it, or to use your arms to lift your head above, you know, a level and peer into something. So I'm not trying to be like cut down in semantics there, but
no. I know up isn't even a very good word, because it would almost imply outwards, like from the microcosm to the macrocosm.
Yes, yes.
If your mind makes that leap, you're now no longer what you're implying. If your mind makes that leap, is that what you are seeing is a corollary to nature itself? Right, because when you leap to the macrocosm level, you're looking at reality almost objectively, as if you are a god. Theoretically,
and
yes,
okay, yes, I agree.
Do you see how the experience of sync then automatically has to become some kind of spiritual thing?
Ooh, okay, like, all right.
Like the contemplation of of the apple by Isaac Newton could be considered to be a spiritual or religious in the same way.
I think that what certain words that we use are victims of what occurred 500 or so years ago, and that we continually use spiritual, or we use the word God, and we use these words because we can get our hands on it, and we can use them as leverage, so we understand what we're talking about. But even just in the language itself, it handicaps us in a way that we're stepping on stones, but we need to break the stones on some level. So, like, by peering into the spiritual or the godlike, it makes us feel like we're separate, or there's a great distance, or there's a great
division there
that I think is what Sink is begging us to throw away. I don't know.
I know. I hear what you're saying. I like, quite frankly, if I can be blunt, and to use a word popular in the parlance, that the statement you just made resonates with what I read out of Jason Barrera as well. The idea that that these synchronistic things, like he referred to spots on the page, like the written word, as a stain upon the pure nature of reality itself, that which gives us a distance or some kind of veil between the truly cosmic and the falsely cosmic. You see what I'm saying?
I absolutely do.
Well, yeah, I hear, so it's like spirit, I think breath. And breath is the thing that connects us all, right? Just like sync is ultimately what connects us.
We breathe together. See, now, it's perfect that you drop in on that exact point, because if you're talking about breathing together, the Latin for breathe together is conspiracy, basically.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. that's literally what it means. So we can get right into the meaty stuff of what's going on these days if you guys want.
Right. I mean, I was taking I was looking at conspiracy as we know it as kind of like people seem to have a reaction to the idea of conspiracy. Like, if you have a if it brings something up for you, if you're aggravated by the idea of conspiracy, you know, there's an ultimate conspiracy that we're all participating in, which is to basically have an aversion to recognizing how we all ultimately are connected, and creating a substitute holographic model of ourselves to put in the place of that realization. And so that's a conspiracy that we all take part in every day. And so on that basis, you could say that underlies every conspiracy that could ever exist, because until you have that conspiracy firmly in place, there's no possibility for any other conspiracy, because you're not in that mindset of us and them until that point. If you're not in a mindset of us and them, how could you take part in some elaborate conspiracy to fuck with everyone else, you know?
It's yes, like having like a room full of mirrors all agree to reflect the same thing.
Yes. It's a consensus reality. So a reality can't, like, if you have a false reality or a substitute reality, the only way to keep that in place is through consensus belief. And so if we're in agreement, it verifies your truth. Even if on some level you know that it's not true, if others agree with it, it gives it more of a sense of authenticity and concreteness.
Okay, well, I love the way you laid that out. So let me ask you this then. So if the conspiracy is that awareness, and I've read this in your Sync Book article too.
Right, so I talk about this.
Really great article, by the way. But so we're talking about the sense of separateness when in fact things are real, or when in fact we are part of a one, is what you're saying, right?
Right. In the midst of that, yes, absolutely.
Yes, okay, so, but has the experience of the one been described or enlightened in some way that we're all missing naturally? Like, this is one of the questions that really dogs me, basically.
Right, absolutely. And so this is the problem, is because people, there's like a need for it to be one or the other. And the idea of we exist within a vacuum and that that vacuum like collapses into itself with a set of very specific dynamics so that there is a pattern, so that there is something to it more than just, oh, we're one. It's like the difference between Samkhya and Vedanta. Like Vedanta is where you have Maya and you have Brahm and everything's one. And so it's like they don't even want to go into the specifics of anything. They're just like, no, just accept that it's one and that's that. And they leave it on that simplistic level, which has... that's not a bad thing to do, but at the same time, there's something to the specific dynamics and to go into the nitty gritty of that. That's not something to just be left aside. And so that's usually like,
No. We can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We have to take the concept of the duality and the one somehow at the same time, or are we flipping in and out of it?
It's that if you have a duality, you have a dual, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. Very interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Knowledge of duality, you're accepting that there is a conflict on some level, which there is, even if not ultimately. But that doesn't mean that that was a thing. Is like if a polarity, what's the difference between a polarity and a duality? Like a polarity is a contrast or a continuum where you have a continual spectrum that's undivided in itself.
Right, like a sphere.
Duality is where you have these two opposing forces that are just like coming up against each other and can't reconcile themselves. So, in Kabbalah you have this, the idea of chesed, is that chesed is actually love and that love has no opposite. So you'd say, Gevurah is the opposite of chesed, but not ultimately, because it's all embracive. If something's all embracive, it doesn't really have an opposite because there is no opposition. In order for something to be an opposite, it implies opposition. But if it's not an opposition to anything, how could that be so?
Right. It's and the one cannot oppose itself.
So is that the purple, then, of the red and blue? I know that mostly... those two sphero are represented by the colors red and blue.
Mm.
And oftentimes, I guess it's not a rule.
You know, I've got a pattern in my head about red and blue myself. And that is that it somehow represents Jupiter, basically.
Like in the Matrix, what if you took both pills?
I know, that's a question that I've often asked. Like, well, what if he had just reached and grabbed both and put them in there? Would he have split into two immediately and we'd have automatically jumped to the end of the third film? That's probably what would have happened. With the whole thing would have just gone to, closing credits.
And how come nobody I talk to seems to like the third film? At least it's their least favorite. And that's my favorite fucking film by far. Like I love
that movie. Of the Matrix films, I like all of them, actually. But the third one is great.
I like the third one more than the second one.
Yeah.
Let me ask you guys something. Did you see it in the theater, both of you guys?
Yes.
Yes.
Did you guys notice the sound of a broken record on the soundtrack?
No.
They've mixed. Yeah. I don't own the movie, so I don't know but there was something very clever they did at the beginning of the film. They mixed the sound into the soundtrack right at the opening credits of a 33 and a third record player skipping at the end. You know how when it goes to the end and it just starts to click, 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 like that? So that's it.
The final sequence of the third film has Sanskrit all throughout it, which is, from darkness, lead me to light, from the unreal, lead me to the real, from death, lead me to immortality. I think I messed up there, but that's what they repeat over and over again as he's battling Mr. Smith.
Oh, okay, interesting. So that gets repeated like a broken record. See, the reason that I bring up the concept of a record is because, Bill, you mentioned blue and red. And for me, that has an immediate connotation with having to do with Jupiter. Well, I see the symbol, the planetary glyph for Jupiter as the needle of a record. If you take out the curve, so there's the question mark part at the top of the two, right?
Oh, I see it perfectly.
Yeah. So the cross now becomes the needle. It's upside down. It's an upside down cross that is a needle. And then there's a curve coming off of that cross, indicating a patterned motion towards the center, right?
I like that.
So it's basically a record player. So it's an interesting thing that we have. And I guess is the broken record then the repetition? What, like, because it just, I'm sorry, this just, it really does tear me apart. This, well, and I don't mean emotionally, but just in the intellectual sense, I can't get over that somehow the two should be able to operate together at the same time, and that we wouldn't be have to reboot things.
You know what I've just been thinking of, which I love, is that when you look at palmistry and people point out that the pointer finger is associated with Jupiter, right. the middle finger is associated with Saturn. And so right. you have Saturn and Jupiter right next to each other in the peace sign. And so I love
Nice. Very nice.
Saturn and Jupiter. And so Saturn is Jupiter's father, and you have the infinite cycle inherent in peace, and so you can't have peace without war, apparently, so people say. That the king is dead, long live the king, every time you say peace.
Interesting. Very cool. Well, see, now that adds flavor to what to my symbol of the record player, because now the planetary glyph for Jupiter, for Saturn, can actually symbolize the hand of God coming and picking up that needle and putting it back at the beginning of the record.
Right, sure. when you say the hand of God, you know the word for hand in Hebrew is yud, right?
Yud,
which is like yud. We associate it as a pictograph with the hand, an open hand, whereas kaf is the grasped hand, right? Which is this interesting thing, because the value of yud, if you spell it out, which as yud and dalet, is actually 14, which is the number of segments on your fingers. So to your fingers.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. That's pretty fascinating.
14 segments that surround the Christian cross when you have the unfolded cube. And so the cube of space is the same amount of segments as the joints in the hand. And then that becomes completely, it says that God has three hands, actually. There's this whole thing around that. Very, very strange, but I it's definitely communicating something in that regard, as far as I can tell.
If he has three hands, I think we could probably guess what the third one is. We might call it the third leg, but no, because if you look at because the hand itself is like a stick man, right? If you take the second and fourth fingers, the ones that are on either side of your middle finger, you have the. He's a tripod, obviously.
Well, it's true. It's more complex that you're there. It's a slightly more complex than that, because you have the issue of the separation of Ze'er from the Shekhinah, and so the third is actually at the center, but it's, and so. The Malkut is associated with the Shekhinah, which is the tip of the dick, right? And Yesod is the testicles. It's like
right.
You have two testaments, testament, testicle, that come from the same place. And so you have the re-enfoldment of the thing brings everything back to the center. And then that is actually the third hand. So that's, and it's basically, you could take it as like Orgon, the Wilhelm Reich idea of Orgon, or
right.
The tantric idea of Kundalini, is that you have this line of force that's through us. So that's, and everything is transcendent in the third piece. That's like a idea. Whenever you have a triangle, you have the two opposites cancel out, and there's a transcendent third. And so that energy that is the energy of creation is the transcendent third, which is the third hand. Yes.
Interesting. Be interesting to see how that applied to the musical scale. I'm glad you've inspired me with that. When you mentioned yud, I had a thought myself about the idea of rebuilding a crippled kingdom, basically, because if that's what we're talking about, if Jupiter plays the record out as Zeus to the natural end of to the bottom of sync, essentially, to where the needle is all the way over at the end of linear time. When Saturn picks it up with the hand, so if the hand is yod, if you have the word imperfect, right, as in not perfect, well, a comma, or in this case an apostrophe, looks very similar to the yud, right? David, are you there? Yeah, like a yud looks like a little apostrophe. It looks like the apostrophe that we put when we pluralize things.
Oh yeah.
You see what I'm getting at? It's sort of there. So if you add the hand of God to the word imperfect, you have I'm perfect. You can put the apostrophe after the I and get I am perfect, basically. I just thought that was an interesting little tidbit that I discovered. I don't know if there's any meaning to that or not, of the idea of the apostrophe as yod. But,
interesting. I mean, the yud itself is supposed to be shaped as a flame, and so that's why the Hebrew alphabet is called a flame alphabet, because the yud exists within every letter. So it's formed out of the hand of God, and flame is the idea.
Right, but there's also this concept but in the tarot, of how one neither no jot or tittle shall be changed, right?
Right.
Right, so that's where it's from that concept that I get this idea of the apostrophe, because that's what we call, you know, when we jot something down, right? We're not using correct language. When you just jot, you're using shorthand. So you wouldn't write he is, you'd write he, H-E apostrophe S. So the apostrophe always comes in when something is being jotted down, essentially. So that's where I got this idea of the jot and the apostrophe being somewhat similar, but I'm not exactly sure if that's.
Is it a true, would it be a skip in the record then? Would it?
Oh, that's very interesting.
Because the word has been shortened out of convenience, out of a race against time, but there is no time. So all you're doing is putting a scratch into the normal flow of the transmission, and what you think you're actually saving, you're actually creating an obstacle, possibly.
That's very interesting, because if we I like that idea a lot, because if it's a scratch, it's like the teenager, it's like the youthful Saturn picking up the needle, wanting to hear a song over again, basically.
Because then you have the whole anger that is infused in music like hip hop, where scratching a record becomes an integral part of the expression.
That's great. That's really interesting.
And obviously, whenever I think of a scratch in a record, I always think of side two of Sgt. Pepper's, where you get locked into infinity with that little loop, right?
Right.
It's weird, because I was in a restaurant the other day, and they were playing Day in the Life, and usually they have that song played on, you know, some kind of radio station. I don't know what they were using, but the song ended, and they played through the silence into that little bit. And they let it play for about, I don't know, about 10, 15 seconds. Mm. And it just colored the moment in such a weird way, because for me, when I discovered that, it was one of the most fascinating parts of that record, and trying to get at exactly what that meant.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, it's... man.
And it all fits in. Because of what David said earlier about how they have in Sanskrit, they have this repeated thing about it was very
from the unreal lead me to the real, from darkness lead me to light, and from death lead
right,
me to eternal life or immortality or whatever.
Right. That's so. There you have it, right there. If that because at that time that's what the Beatles were doing. They were hanging out with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, right, when they were making Sgt. Pepper or putting it together.
You know, there might even be a certain sort of that technically that record plays like that forever until it transfers over into a digital medium.
Right, right.
Until that, it makes the leap into CD.
But that song seems to be about time specifically in the first place, because you have that it's all perceptual. So it's dependent upon, like, I wake up, I roll out of bed, my shoes, ran a comb across my head. Like, he's just like, but he, it's like, when I play that song, when I DJ it, I always do a thing where I do 45 for the slow parts. So when he's going slow, I turn it to 45. And then right when it goes back into the fast parts, I push 33 so it slows down, and I work the pitch control to make it as high or as low as I can for either one, so that it's actually relatively balanced. Like, even though it's not really balanced, it's still like just playing with that, you know. But I like the idea of like that song is expressing that time is perceptual. And that, like,
and what it also does, that's a very easy, see your little trick there when you DJ it. I'll bet you lots of kids were doing something similar to that. They wanted to try to, they would put their finger probably actually on the record and try to get it to play at an even speed.
Mm.
So in a sense, you can see how that it forces the interface with the material media itself. Right, you're no longer just listening anymore. You're actually putting, and the same thing with all the stuff. the backwards masking being done by Led Zeppelin and whatnot. It actually gets people to take their claw. Yeah. They take a claw-like finger and they scratch the record around. Oh my gosh, that's extraordinary.
Yeah, I see that. I see a lot of like musicians like either consciously or unconsciously trying to push us to participate.
Sure. But I mean,
like performance,
and that's a grand artistic idea. You hear lots of artists talk about that. I want to, you know, get. But I think that's these discoveries, particularly the audio media of the late 1960s and early 70s, when they were, you know, beginning to do all of this stuff. If indeed that is when it was being begun, it might have happened sooner, and we haven't discovered it yet. But I just think that's an extraordinarily potent act. I mean, it goes beyond art. We're talking about technology almost here now. You're actually getting people to reach out and move.
The hand of God.
Yes, exactly. And isn't that what Crowley says himself, right? Is that every man and woman is a god, right? So
man and woman is a star.
There is no god but man. Yeah.
Right.
That's from, I think it's from the Book of Lies, or Book of the Law, rather. But
I don't know if I believe him, though.
I'm not so sure. Well, no, I'm not sure I do either. I'm not. I mean, yeah. It's a good question.
What if he said every man and woman is a squirrel?
He said actually every man and woman is a czar, as far as I...
Yes, sure. No, that's right, because that's how Robert Anton Wilson kind of appropriated that. Every man and woman is a czar.
So what, that was a weird thing, was that I found that the word Israel, actually in its roots, you have Yehuda, right? But I like this, that you have, it's from the same root as czar, so which is Caesar. Really? So Caesar and Israel have the same etymological root, as a matter of fact. I was kind
of
blown
away. Here's a little tidbit. Have you guys heard or seen the documentary film called The Gospel of Caesar?
I have not.
No.
Okay. This will blow both of you guys away. It's definitely up your alley. And anybody who might be listening to this too, who's interested in sync, this guy who's a student of the Bible, and he's a serious investigator, believes that the ritual of Christ's death is actually a deliberate metaphor for the murder of Caesar. And his subsequent burial.
I've heard that, but are you referring? Because I mean, Titus Caesar was the one.
This would be Julius. Yeah.
So Julius, that's long before, but sure.
Yeah, no, that's right. It is long before. Yes, yeah, it's long before Christ. Yeah,
well,
is it the idea
in the sense that you can kill the emperor and then the emperor is there again the next day?
That's exactly right. And they actually, this guy talks about how they produced a body, right? They actually parade around an effigy of the deceased king 3.5 days.
That is actually, I believe that was in the Golden Bough.
Okay, there you go. That's extraordinary. So,
it goes much further back than Caesar. But if you can find it with Caesar, then you can find it.
Of course. No. When I heard the story, though.
Ethnological question as to whether or not that is just something that we fucking cannot not do. That's planned, that's, you know, this elaborate, you know,
so-called grand narrative.
Yeah, very, or that we did it for so long that it became embedded in a cycle. Right. Like if we just put so much towards that ritual that it just ended up continually playing out into eternity, basically.
So on some level, America has been run by 4-year-olds and 8-year-olds.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the attitude. No, it's true.
That's the Aeon of Horus, isn't it? The crowned and conquering child that we put in the most powerful, or seemingly the most powerful position, someone who can only age 8 years into the position, and that we will always have someone 1 year beyond the age of reason as our leader.
Fascinating idea. Of course, yeah. Of course, yeah. No, I think, and the subsequent, you know, I mean, if you're whether you're a fan of Mad Men or whether you've studied the history of advertising going back to Bernays or whatever, the idea of the product being produced speaking to the child inside of you, whatever's being sold, whatever it's being marketed, whether it's tobacco or Starbucks or you know, marijuana. It's always being targeted to that kid in you. That's the one that can't say no, right?
Absolutely.
When temptation is offered. So what you're saying is that each so-called president then becomes an enfant terrible. And there's no way to avoid it because he only has so much time to mature. That's very, very nice. Yeah.
Because, like, Obama now is starting to get a certain temperament that I think people are starting to take notice of. Because he knows he's dying. He knows he's a dead and dying king, right?
Sure, sure,
he's
yeah.
He's on his way out. And so there's this, I don't know if it's rage or fire, but there's something in him that is speaking louder and taller. And I'm interested to see where he's going to take this.
Well, you guys can check the date of this, but here's a little interesting kind of a sink, excuse me, a little sink drop. A massive gold nugget was found somewhere. I don't know if you guys caught this on the news. But somebody mined a single gold nugget that weighed more than 30 pounds or something like that. And it's in the shape of a giant phallus. No. And I believe that this was discovered on the same day as Obama's inauguration, on the Sunday, basically. So we have this concept of Obama potentially being Osiris in some way, right? Or being strongly representative of Osiris.
Sure.
And I believe it was with you guys that I talked about the idea of, because I like to, I'm not a great mathematician, not a skilled one, but I do like math and numbers. And the factor of 14, which is the so-called number of pieces on the reassembled Osiris,
right,
is just a little over 7 billion, right? So we could potentially be talking about like a harmonization of events where the world reaches a critical mass of people, which would be the factor of 14. And a factor is when you take the number 14 and then you multiply it by 13 and then by 12 all the way down to 1, you would get a number just slightly more than 7 billion, which is very close to the number of the peoples of Earth. So if we're talking about the reassembly, I mean, because these themes repeat themselves so strongly, if we're talking about the reassembly of Osiris, if we're talking about the number of combinations of pieces, of 14 different pieces having to be, you know... Well,
imagine go ahead. This shit. So... You know, the standard myth is that the average human being, or most human beings, use 10% of their brain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if there's we hit 7 billion people in the planet, and 10% of them are online at the same time?
Right.
So, on a sense that the globe is using 10% of its completed brain, and that's
very
the moment where the noospheric baby child opens its eyes and... starts to think for itself.
Very interesting. Yeah, it's so. Boy. But perhaps there's something of a genetic. Well, no, not perhaps. Maybe there's something genetic going on here too, and having to do with the recombination of genes of some kind, leading towards some sort of new human being. I don't know about that.
Huh? Did you get a chance to look at Alan's new book that he's been working on? Did he send that to you?
No, he didn't, no.
You've been looking at it, Bill? Did you get
yes.
to see his?
Yes, I have.
So it would be he can't make it today. He might stop in for a minute, but he's definitely this area. I mean, the specifics of what you're saying, not necessarily, but the King Kill, it's all about the King Kill, and he just goes on, and it's fucking genius. I think you'd really like it.
I'm looking forward to reading, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
That's the Suicide Kings is his new book, right?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't even know it was finished, but again, I've been out of the loop. I haven't been paying attention to anything, so...
Well, he sent me an unfinished copy, but he's pretty damn far along, so I don't know where he's at now with it. But yeah, it's just... it's also applicable, the idea of Osiris and how we project the archetype of Osiris onto everybody that we put in any position of power and how fucking weird that is.
It's weird.
It
scares the shit out of me.
Of it. Yeah, the Lion King thing that he he is the Lion King, and then you you have Osama and Obama, and how Osama is literally, how does Osama translate again? Isn't it the lion?
Yeah, it comes from Japanese. Yeah, Osama and Obama from Japanese.
Yeah, well, Obama is a lightning flash.
Right, that's right.
As
that's
like. Barak.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is different from Baruch. Baruch is the Hebrew, and Barak is the Aramaic, or vice versa, or something like that. Oh no, I think it might be vice versa. Anyway, yeah. So you say Barak star. I was just, this was a thing, was like when I was mentioning the czar thing and how weird it is, Caesar and Israel and that. But czar is an anagram for star, and so right. I got this whole kick a while back of, you know, every man and woman is a czar, and just how that translates in terms of like the way that Israel tends to be taken by people as like this is the Holy Land and the chosen people, instead of looking at it, you know, you could just as easily take it as these are the people who choose. And what Crowley begs us to do with our free will is to utilize it to the utmost completely, right? So you have, you know, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, and until humanity can actually like learn to like make its own choices and not be conditioned like little children to do what they're told, but to actually find out for themselves why and why not, that translates directly, that in that case we would actually be our own rulers, we would be our own Caesars, and then Israel would be everywhere, is how that would you know,
which is that's a Gnostic awakening of a sort, right? I mean, sure. because the idea of the supposedly heretical idea of Gnosticism that Christ gives every human being a piece of himself, which is then grafted onto his soul and making him essentially the Caesar or the Tsar, right?
Right.
So each person in Gnosticism supposedly has that awakening where they feel like they are at the dead center of the universe, essentially.
Well, that's the thing that tends to be missed, I think, when people speak of the Sicarii. So when you look at the fact that you had these Jewish rebels who, you know, were obviously not people who were about the gospel, but they had their own Christianity. And so when you hear about Christians being killed, are you hearing about gospel Christians being killed? Or are you hearing about the Sicarii? And the fact that they had to hide the text of their religion, the Nag Hammadi and you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls in fucking caves.
Sure.
It's definitely very telling. And so you'll see why it's anti-establishment is because of this very reason, because they want people to rule themselves, ultimately, is what's being expressed. And that's liberation. And they recognize that in order to have a liberation, you can't start on the cosmetic level and reform and change on that level. You have to change the perception. You have to change the being. Mm. And so that's, you know, that's what it comes down to.
Is there a difference between an atomic civilization and a nuclear civilization?
I wouldn't say so. Not. I mean, that's a good question. Maybe the atomic is the nuclear would be the exploded.
Well, in the sense that the nuclear is the nucleus, but the right. atomic includes the nucleus.
Mm. Yeah, I guess so.
So really, you should have an atomic village of atoms working in concert together. So atom rules itself. But if you can bust that up and say, you have to be a nuclear family, you're really exposed and you're really vulnerable and you really can't do it all yourself.
We're a atomic family. See, that's the thing. Everybody's a split nuclear family. See, if it was actually, you have electrons spinning, you know, so fast in the six directions, right? You know, and everything always attempts to find an equilibrium. We live in a society where there is an ultimate equilibrium, and some distortion was introduced that we are continually trying to reconcile. And so I think the excitement that comes up around sync is that there's actually a feeling of a reconciliation of the split atom. Like we exist within a bomb, basically.
Mm.
Elected Obama. We just felt
it. You know, you mentioned how Barak means lightning or thunder and lightning,
right?
Can you guys remember back to Ehud Barak of Israel?
No.
Yeah, he was the prime minister of Israel for a little while before. His name was Ehud Barak.
I should.
This is in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s. And he's still a powerful political figure in Israel. The reason I mention him is because Ehud means left-handed, right?
Oh, okay. I gotcha.
And I just, as an interesting little string, Obama is also left-handed, so that's interesting as well.
Yeah, what's the deal with presidents and left-handedness? There's like a 40% ratio.
Is that right? Is it 40%?
It's something astounding. I think Clinton's a left-hander.
Wow. They're all Gavorian. That's like, there's just like a need for the, you can only have people on the left-handed path really, operate in that position or that.
When you say, okay, Gabura, you're referring to the tree of life, right? What are the attributes of Gabura? Is that Jupiter as well?
Well, in the European system, yes, it's associated with Jupiter.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. The lightning hand in the left hand.
Esoteric traditional is Jupiter, actually, and then Saturn. But yeah, people take it now is it actually Mars? I forget what the Golden Dawn takes it as. I think they have that. But basically, it's feminine. But it's intensity. It's like the intense upset female. You can see it in like the in Crowley's deck, the Queen of Wands. That's supposed to be representative of Gavura, I believe, where you have the
woman. But also, if you have a kind of a left-hand path idea coming here, in the Tarot Magician as well, it's the left hand that comes down, right? That points downward to the ground. And so that could be the so-called point of contact between something hovering between Mars and Jupiter and the Earth, essentially, right, where the left hand of the magician comes down. I mean, this would get pretty tricky if you were talking about tarot attributions, because you'd be looking at more than just the individual cards, but you'd be attaching the cards in sequences where you could follow the lines of the pictures themselves or the pictographs. So maybe, like, I guess what I'm saying is maybe this point, maybe it's the gates of Mars.
Hey, so, okay, just real quick. 6 out of the last 14 presidents have been left-handed, right?
Interesting.
Now, the general population is 10% left-handed. What do you think the percentage of 6 out of 14 is?
Well, yeah, it's a little more. Well, what is it?
42.8%.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. See, there you go. Yeah, yeah. Fascinating.
I like how in the Devil card in the Rider deck, the hand that's lighting Adam's tail on fire is actually his left hand, while his right hand holds up the Saturn symbol.
Oh, very interesting.
And, you know, Saturn symbol almost looks like an upside-down Jupiter symbol.
Okay, well, see now, okay, this is good. This is good because you've done it here, David. If we can now say that the left hand of the magician, right, if we superimpose that over the left hand of the devil, because the position is the same,
sure.
Then what we have, the tail of the male would actually be the penis. And he's reaching out with the left hand. Boy, this puts a whole new spin on Catholicism.
Right. You know, but, the devil card two in the Rider deck, I believe from the female's tail, she's actually pulling part of a pomegranate off.
Yes.
And the pomegranate was what Persephone was given in the underworld from
Hades. That's right.
And then if you remember in The Matrix Reloaded, it's Persephone that wants to kiss Neo and has the whole thing where she won't let them get what they're after unless
until he kisses her. Yeah, that's right. Which gives us Salome as well.
Uh-huh.
And so then Neo becomes the head of John the Baptist. Like, we might be talking about of course. See, now, so what we're doing, okay, so if we have this hand that you say comes down lighting the tail of the male, okay? So if Saturn is the upper portion of that and we move it down past Jupiter into the gates of Mars, then what we have is the hand reaching through Jupiter and touching the arrow that rises on the astrological symbol for Mars.
Huh.
See, so there might be a way, and the reason, you see what I'm, because this all makes sense, teleologically, going from the upper hand of the devil, which has the Saturn symbol, and then coming down through the left hand and touching, igniting the phallus, the so-called tail, and then that tail becoming the point that rises from Mars. So there might be a way to actually arrange the cards in such a way that they're creating an actual shape of Osiris. I mean, this is interesting.
Okay, so there's what Alejandro Jodorowsky did. Have you seen his mandala, his tarot mandala that he did? Tarot?
Yeah, that's...
I've seen the mandala, yeah.
It's incredible. I've laid it out a few times, actually. this is a trip. It's a giant swastika, and it's the specific... His book, what is it? The Way of Tarot. It's like just absolute genius. But he works it out with the Marseille Tarot. If you try and work it out with the Crowley deck, it would be interesting to see. But there's some specifics about the way that the uniformity of the small cards of the Marseille Tarot, the way that one will actually meet the one next to it, it's very particular and it's not easily reproduced in other decks. But
using the Rider-Waite deck.
Right, you can't do it because the Rider-Waite deck, the small cards aren't uniform. They're uniform in the Golden Dawn deck, but not in the way that helps you form the mandala that Jodorowsky points out.
Oh, okay.
The fact that you can lay out this solar symbol in the way that you can is really something else. It's something extraordinary.
Hmm.
I'll try and find a picture that I took of it here while we're talking.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
So it'll take me a minute. So,
okay, now I have to add this just because, you know, my own fascination carries me this way. But is it possible that nobody has yet completely correctly laid this out? Because you have this idea of the ninth from Polanski's The Ninth Gate, right? About you have these symbols that if they're laid out in a certain correct order, then some sort of gate opens, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So, but obviously only one person that's interesting. Makes me wonder. Go ahead.
So, but is there, I mean, isn't that up to the individual?
Well, maybe.
It's like, I mean, there is an arrangement, like Jodorowsky shows you the mandala that he has constructed. But to think that that is your mandala might not be accurate.
I see what you're saying.
So
yeah,
that
yeah.
In your own headspace, you need to find your own mandala. And when you do, it's undeniable what happens.
That makes sense. Oh, yeah.
I mean, or maybe he's showing you a way, like a generic way of doing it. But really, when you get involved with it, in some inspiration... you will find a mandala that you line up with in a certain night, in a certain sort of state of mind that makes the thing happen.
I didn't like the idea at first, but no, I think you're actually right, because I was trying to... one of my favorite movies is The Ninth Gate. It's a film that I've seen many, many times. Probably seen that single film just for pure pleasure without ever studying it more than any movie I've ever seen.
Based on an Alan Moore story?
No, it's not actually. It's based on a Spanish novel called the Dumas Club. It's about a bunch of people who find a secret code hidden in the Three Musketeers by or maybe the Man in the Iron Mask. I haven't actually read the book.
It could just as easily have called The Ninth Gate The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Well, because you know you have it all centers around strength. The tarot card. You can see the tet that appears in the pieces that he's collecting.
Yes.
And the
yes.
way the actual gate, I mean, so that was a significance of when you have the, I think the tarot tableau that Crowley laid out, he has a different version where you have, because of the way he changed the arcana, just when you show the hero's journey in terms of the upper and the lower in representation, you know what I'm talking about? Basically, he puts it so that you have the center of the whole thing is Leo, which is strength,
right.
which is Oz. Oz is Hebrew for strength, and so when Crowley represents that, that's why he has the Shekinah, or what he's taking in the Christian sense is the horror of Babylon, riding atop the beast, which he's identifying himself with. What is the significance of him identifying himself, but the fact that he believed that because he had figured this out that he had rights to that, so to speak.
Of course. That makes sense. Because in thinking of these things, I tend to get hung up on the idea that, for me, this has to do, it's personal, because it has to do with an extraordinary lack of self-confidence that I have. No. I'm essentially, Kierkegaard on acid, basically. So whenever I perceive a story, but both of you guys have clarified that for me, it now makes sense. And the end of the movie, The Ninth Gate, makes sense now too, much more sense than it made before, because you guys have seen The Ninth Gate, I assume, both of you.
Sure. Yes.
Yeah. So when the character played by Frank Langella, who interestingly enough originated Dracula on Broadway,
that's the man who sets himself on fire.
Yes, that's right. He's actually he is succeeding. This is what always bothered me, was like the way the story appears to be told is that the character played by Johnny Depp, Dean Corso, is the only one who's passing through the Ninth Gate. And so I superimpose that concept onto my own lack of self-confidence. And I think to myself, I'll never get through that gate. Johnny Depp's already been through it, but it makes sense now, because now when Balkan sets himself on fire, that's him passing through the gate. And Depp is the exterior witness to that, the one standing right behind him next in line. That's all. And then he goes through in his own way, and so on and so on. So that actually makes – that clarifies the end of that film for me. It's kind of a spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen the movie. But, yeah, that's an interesting idea.
And that's about Polanski, how, right?
It is, yeah. Polanski, yes. Yeah.
Ooh, I wonder.
I've thought about studying this film. It's actually really worth – and many people have written about it, obviously – at great length. I've read quite a few good articles out there about it, but there are lots of neat little clues in there, and little tie-ins to Rosemary's Baby as well. So,
sure.
And great sound, amazing sound technique. There's a scene in the film. Go ahead.
This is like a really nice sink that's been on my mind, is the Andy thing. So,
are you kidding me?
So Rosemary's Baby is named Andy, right?
Right.
And so I love how I've been connecting so Man on the Moon with Andy Kaufman. There's this whole phenomenon. So you have I'm going to jump around a little bit here, but in Toy Story, you have the little boy's name is Andy, right? And he writes his name on the bottoms of his toy's feet. Right. And so there's this whole thing around that Tom Hanks has, Andy on his foot or whatever. And then you have this like spaceman. But the fact that you have the shining carpet appear upstairs, and you have this whole thing that's being emphasized, which is because of Freud's The Uncanny, which was an inspiration for how The Shining was presented, where you have the idea of why toys coming to life is so fucking terrifying for people, especially children. And then you have the 237 appearing throughout it. I find it really interesting that if you watch the video of REM's song Man on the Moon, there's actually like clips where, because Michael Stipe is dressed as a cowboy, he's like, and there's an astronaut jumping around. There's actually a cut where you have a cowboy and an astronaut right next to each other. Heard about this one, and it's about the idea that we fake the moon landing. It's like, and if you believe we put a man on the moon, it's like the have you heard about this, like this conspiracy, and so it's like, it's a joke, it's like the conspiracy is a joke, that the act, like that it's a joke on the public or something, and that Andy Kaufman was all about playing jokes on the public and fooling everybody. And so, but then you have like, do you see where I'm going with this? Like, and then they have Rosemary's Baby is named Andy in the book. That's what they say. His name is Andy. And then she's arguing over that his name is Andy, but they're wanting to know, like, they want to change the name or whatever. So I don't know. And then Andy is also not letter by letter, because you have an extra N, but it's a rearrangement of Danny.
Yes. And it also gives us androgynous too.
Sure.
It's also, and John Dee's wife was named Anne. Right?
Oh, and D.
John D. and Edward Kelly, and there was some beef between John D. and Edward Kelly because of a supposed affair between Kelly and John's wife, Anne, which sort of mirrors what happened with L. Ron Hubbard, you know, 400 years later with Parsons, right? That Parsons ran away with Hubbard ran away with Parsons' boat and his girl and his $20,000.
Oh my!
So I've been obsessing about Anne D. I don't know what to make of it, but it's been in my head for the last like 4 days. So I don't know how that fits in.
You know that it's actually a matter of fact that the character of 007 is based on John D.
Yeah.
Yes.
Look who I'm talking to. I can't tell you guys anything.
Well, this ties into this book that I just read, Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Renaissance. And it's just been a huge eye-opener for me. But I guess I'll throw this in here, is that Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake. History says because of his opinions of Copernican theory and heresy against the Catholic Church. But he's a lot more complicated than that. But one of the things that I found so fascinating about his stance was that he wanted to take magic and Kabbalah before the Jewish Kabbalah and straight into pure Egyptianism.
Right.
Because his stance was that systems like the Tree of Life were designed to thwart demonic energies. Right? And that the Egyptian magic...
That's the exact reverse of Philip K. Dick's idea, by the way. But go on anyway.
So this is what my reading is so far. That Bruno said that you wanted the demonic energies in your magic and Kabbalah. That it was essential to get to the transcendent experience so that you could complete what magic and Kabbalah was compelling you to get to.
Sure.
And so all these later systems hedge their bets by trying to make it a little bit safer, make it a little bit cleaner, maybe to make it a little bit more marketable, to make it a more effective political machine. So, you know, this is all about language. What does he mean by angelic and demonic magic, and what is the demonic influences? Well, the demonic influences would be, you know, shadow magic, the uncanny. The things that you can't control, right? The things that... Right.
Which you can't have the light without that. Like, that's the thing. That's about... The Kleepotes serve a real function.
Yes.
There's a whole thing in the Gemara of Job, the story of Job, where, you know, Job gets... everything goes to shit in Job's life. There's an explanation there that it's because he never fed the Kleepote, that he was too perfect, basically.
Absolutely.
And he didn't acknowledge the darkness. He didn't acknowledge the shell or the husk or whatever you want to call it, the thing that surrounds the tree that wants to get in. And so because he ignored it completely, it came through the back door, basically, and just destroyed everything.
I think that I'll take a little leap of faith here, but I think that when I speak about certain experiences that I had and Mark speaks about certain experiences he had, I think maybe it's a leap of faith, but I think that we're perfect examples of people who were living maybe a little too perfect or a little too nice of a life. And then when dabbling with these magics, that Kleefotic energy just freight trained us.
Boy, that's exactly what happened to me. Yeah. Although, I mean, I wouldn't say with certainty that it was the Kleefotic energy, but it makes sense in terms of what we're talking about, because my life was turned upside down, literally upside down as a result of it. So yeah, I agree with that it, but I wonder, do some people, you know, talking to, say, you, David, you give off the impression, to me at least, that you kind of waltz through this like one of the Terpsichorean gods themselves, just gliding through like a figure skater. Do you think that all people... I don't know you, but that's just how you come across to me, as one of those people who, you know, who is just so damn cool, basically. And I mean that in the sense of how you manage a situation. Talking to you, you seem that way to me.
I've had my share of hellishly intense introspective nightmares.
All right, well, so there you have it. So maybe, so this it's interesting because your whole Andy Kaufman thing now, it fits in perfectly with my moon theory, basically, which is that at the center of the moon is where this, although it's the imaginary center of the moon, essentially.
Andy is the moon child, let's not forget.
Yes, yes, of course, yeah, yeah.
Oh, this is perfect. So I think this goes perfectly into your Sync Book 2 piece, Mark.
Yeah, it does go into that, because that's kind of what happened to me, is that the moon sort of started to shine very bright, and my world became a lunatic world, lunar central, basically.
Right. Well, you know that, so just like Crowley is the beast, Jack Parsons is the Antichrist.
And right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Antichrist, but the moon to the sun. So if Christ is the sun, the moon becomes the anti-sun, basically, which right, all right. It is reflect. All it does is reflect. That's why at the end of Rosemary's Baby, you have, you know, Mia as reconciles it. She's like, she looks at it, and it all it does is reflect. It's like talk about Kevin, where she just still loves the child. Yes. You know? It's that whole phenomenon of like you can
see. Sure, that's why that might be why she wants to stick so strongly to the name of Andy, because that way the child can be androgynous. It doesn't have to be specifically male, so that when she looks at it, it's a reflection of herself, essentially. Sure. Sure. That's the exact Gnostic theory that I have about the moon, that it becomes right. The mirror in which the so-called Shekinah or the woman sees herself, basically, right. Her vanity. Right, that's very interesting.
Why Parsons has a crater named after him on the dark side of the moon.
Right. Isn't the cough the back of the head?
I know that's a koof.
Koof is the back of the head. Cough is actually the clutched fist.
Yeah.
And that's why there's this relationship between Yud and Kaf. One is the beginning of the double letters. It's kind of a lot to go into, but numerically there's a significance there. I just watched a movie last night called Dark Horse, which wasn't very good. But Mia Farrow was in it, which I wasn't expecting. And there's a reference to Kabbalah in it that he actually says. He's like, I'm talking about Kabbalah, but not the Madonna kind. And he's talking about numerology and stuff. And I don't know. There's not much to go into there other than just the idea that he's emphasizing that he's the dark horse as opposed to the light. And that he's referencing Kabbalah there, and you have, you know, Rosemary hanging out. Like, it was just, Rosemary's his mother, actually, in it, and then he's the dark horse. I just, that was, like,
perfect. Interesting. Yeah, yeah, that's perfect,
I just watched that movie, too, David, and I thought that movie could have been so much better. I thought there was a lot to work with there.
Is it a new film? Is it a recent film?
Last year or so. It's Todd Solondz, who's done amazing films.
I love Solondz. I've loved everything I've seen by him so far.
But I just watched Dark Horse, and I just saw Jeff Who Lives at Home.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good one.
But, I mean, I put them in the category of, like, the movie Juno. There's a...
Right.
There's a preciousness to it, and there's, I think, a dearth of understanding. There's, like, a...
There's sync value.
But it's like sentimental sync value. It's.
I don't like movies like that either. I hated Juno.
You know, but I'm compelled to watch them out of a need to speak to them accurately if they ever come up in conversation. So I can't just say, I hate that shit because I know what it is from afar. I need to really own the motherfucker. But, like, I don't know. It seemed like. Like, there was this sort of superficial understanding of the character, but it didn't go deeper there's no reason to go deeper. Like, I don't know. Maybe it was just a personal affront because certain threads of it scared me personally. You know, it was like, it seemingly came too close to home, and so I wanted the knife to go deeper, but they never really brought the knife deeper. I don't know.
I couldn't tell what was dream and what was real until the very end. And I'm like, okay, did he die? Okay, he died. Okay.
Great. Thanks for spoiling it, brother.
Whatever.
Spoiler alert, David.
No, actually, that doesn't bother me at all, quite frankly.
Yeah, no,
It's a very good movie. End of something doesn't
stop it in sync, actually. Yeah. Mirrorball.
Yes.
Tell us about the Mirrorball.
Well, sure. Okay. Basically, the idea works like this. It's you're on the inside of a spherical bubble, and the interior surface of that bubble is mirrored in the way that a police window is mirrored. It's a one-way mirror, so on the exterior, it glows white light, but on the inside, that white light is broken down into all the rainbow colors, basically, which appear. Now, I came up with this idea because in a physics class, I learned that the surface of a bubble is actually a set of an endless set, an infinite set of ever-decreasing rainbows. So you have a full rainbow, and then next to that you have one that's half that size, and then so on and so on, getting narrower and narrower and narrower to the point of infinity. So this idea that inside the moon, so I mean this with all due respect to you guys, this is just my theory, but you say that the moon can only reflect, and I think that's true of the exterior moon, but I think the interior moon is the opposite of reflection. I think it represents introspection, basically.
Sure.
It's something that's trapped inside the very center of reality that can only contemplate itself. And this goes to the whole man in the moon idea that you came up with very nicely. Because essentially what you have then is you have the colors of the rainbow representing the seven veils of Isis, right, that can't be crossed. Because beyond that you have the pure white light, right, in the Ein Sof and the Ein Sofar. So you have the abyss, which is represented, and crossing this abyss are these seven veils. And they dance, like Salome dances, essentially, representing the feminine aspect admiring herself in modulation, okay? So in a sense, we're seeing our holographic universe is representative of the modulation of images that the woman sees of herself. And this begins with the color red, all right? It actually goes in order no matter what. So you have red at the beginning, and that pairs with the day of the week, Friday, basically. And then you go through each, and you find that the moon, Monday, is the middle day, and so is the color green. So at the center you have Osiris, or the crucified Christ, who represents a nail. He is the Vav that holds the universe together at its dead center. And that's what he becomes. He becomes the man in the moon, essentially, the introspective person, recognizing the accomplished kingdom, right? So these are the last words of Christ. He says it is accomplished, and then he dies. But what I'm saying is that his death becomes essentially the first resurrection. It resurrects because it nails. You see, my basic theory about reality, and to me this is just like very plain common sense, is that it really can't be happening. I mean, it ought to be spinning off into nothingness at every possible opportunity, and yet it adheres somehow. So therefore, there must be a point at which it's held together. Essentially, right. to me, that central point is representative. And the reason I use Christ as the model is just because I'm the most well-versed in that, basically.
Sure, sure. No, it's actually a very ingenious idea with the Vavs, because the Vavs as the nail are what hold him, what graft him onto the tree. So
that's right.
One hand at Gevura, one hand at Chesed, and his feet at Malkut.
That's right.
And so you have the nail is actually six, right? So you have Vav is six, so you have 666 holding him to the tree. The crown that's on top of the letters in the Torah is actually represented. Since it's Zions, it's actually three Vavs with three Yuds atop each one, which is also 666. So it's actually expressing a fractal, where you have on a magnified level, you have the same thing as on a very minute, smaller scale. And actually, that crown is taken to be at Tiferet, and Da'at is actually supposed to be the Yud atop it. Ultimately, it's Keter, but that crown becomes a crown of thorns as Da'at. And so he becomes your basically your fault. It's a temporary thing to hold the tree together in order to build the empire. Malkut literally translates as empire. In order to build you have to have something there holding the tree in place through the power of the imagination.
Well, this the whole 666 thing, 666 patterns that you mentioned fits right into my theory, I think, because what I've done is I've taken the normally sixth day of the week, which is Friday, right? And I've made it into the first day. So, and of course, a Vav is a nail. And even though it's the numerical six in the Hebrew attribution, a nail is still a one. It's a spike, basically. Mm-hmm. So you have the six and one being representative of each other. So So to continue then, that particular matrix, which is a mirror matrix nailed together at its center by the color green, mm-hmm. and having seven colors that can mix in a wide variety of combinations. Go ahead, Bill.
So this, I'm just saying, this ties into what you wrote about the Big Lebowski, right?
And yes.
That the Nihilist's album, Autobahn, is Nagelbett, which is nail matrix.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, bed of nails. Yeah.
So that's the 666 is the nail matrix, right?
Right.
But Vav can also mean pin.
Yes.
So the dude doesn't have the 666 nail matrix. He doesn't know how to use that. It's shown when he nails the wooden block to the floor.
Yes, of course.
And the chair falls down.
He
chooses the system of the 10 pins, which would be the tree of life.
Mm.
Which is anathema to the Jesus, right? That's sort of like who's dressed in all purple. So
that's very clever. And I think, to me, since we're, you know, the Coen brothers in this way are master deceivers. And I don't mean that as a criticism in the negative sense. For instance, as an example of this, I could use From a Serious Man. A Serious Man is of the Coen brothers' films comes the closest to outing Kabbalah as a part of their work, because they actually, they talk about it directly. But the thing of it is, what the expression Hoshi'eni, which means help me in Hebrew, in no way can adds up to what they say it adds up to, which is a phone number, like a seven-digit number.
Yeah, I've been meaning to check that. I saw that, and I was like, I need to actually do some homework. We Netflixed it, and then my girlfriend put it in the box, and I was like, fuck, I wanted to
do that. They come up with some absurd number that it represents. Now,
it wrong. He never added up the numbers. Like, he just takes them all separate. He doesn't know how to work gematria.
Right, right, right. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, Hoshi'eni maybe is a phone number with single letters.
Just add up the numbers. He never added them up. He just takes them all as separate. He just figures
as
out.
As separate, I see. Yes, okay, that makes sense. I'll have to look at that now. See, I could be wrong. It appears I am wrong. I didn't think of him taking them as single numbers. But obviously that would mean that everything in Hoshi'eni would have to be a single-digit number, right? And there's an ion in there, so we know there's a 70 in there at least. So he
That was the first thing ever written in any alphabet language is the equivalent of what you're saying in Aramaic.
Really?
So,
help me,
L is the first thing ever written.
Very
that's the first thing ever written.
That's what I saw on this documentary that was, it was legit. It wasn't like an internet documentary. That doesn't make it more legit, but they gave a whole argument for the date, and it's in a cave and then out in the wilderness, and
is very interesting. That is very interesting. Yeah, so, okay, all right. Well, I mean, I think that going back to what you were saying about the Big Lebowski, I really the idea of the dude, the way in which certain – okay, I'm babbling here. I have a lot of difficulty with the Coen brothers because – and I don't mean difficulty understanding their films. I think I actually do understand them, and I think that they are tricksters essentially. And I can – unfortunately, you know, maybe I should write an article about this. They've done a lot of things in their movies that are – highly questionable. I do talk about them in my lengthy article on the Big Lebowski, basically. In a sense, I would have to say that the Coen brothers are kind of anti-Gnostic, in a sense. Like, that is to say, you can't know, basically, or you will never know. Seems to be the underlying message of their movies. And I'm not sure that idea in and of itself is the opposite of Gnosticism, because to have a Gnostic experience means that you do know, basically. So the question of whether you can or can't know is, I think, at the heart of their movies, and I think they're saying you can't know. And
but
yet,
it depends on what you mean by no. Because when you say no, you could say that what you'll have is closer and closer representations, but it will, by necessity, have to be a representation.
It appears to be problematic, but I guess what I'm talking about is the completed Gnostic experience, the so-called wake-up call, basically, which, for me, enabled me to make this, to come up with this model of the holographic universe that I think is fairly profound.
You don't take the higher expressions of the Gnostic experience to be a disillusion of knowledge into pure being?
Yes, I do, actually. I do. But that's the whole point.
Well, then, there you go.
Knowledge in that sense becomes irrelevant. Maybe interesting to talk about, certainly interesting to talk about. But yeah, no, I agree with that idea completely. But that dissolution is the, to me, it's the crown of knowing. It's not...
Sure.
It's like the bubbles on the champagne when you lift it to your mouth to drink it, essentially. So it's not really a dissolution. And again, you know, this fits in with Crowley's idea of the art card. Well, he calls it art.
Which is 14.
Temperance. Yes, that's right. And the term salve et coagula it means to dissolve is to coagulate, right?
Right.
So dissolve and coagulate. So
What does he have written across the top in Latin? That's the
That's what's there. It says salve.
I thought it was a stone underground or something was there. The stone, something about the stone.
No? There's more. The salve coagula is written at the top, and then there's more text. I'm not sure what it says. I don't have it in front of me right now either. But yeah, salve coagula is written at the top, and then underneath it in smaller text is written some other stuff, and it's probably about the stone, yeah, which makes sense in terms of alchemy.
Oh, I'll look it up as we're talking.
Here's some interesting asides for you guys. I just want to throw these out there because we were talking earlier about Rosemary's Baby. Did you know that there's a famous actor born on the day of Rosemary's, same day as Rosemary's Baby? And this person's the only famous person that I can find who was born on that day, and it's John Cusack, of all people.
Oh, JC.